From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. It says something about Elon Musk that his high-speed travel-by-tube idea generated such eager enthusiasm this week rather than dismissive disdain. Musk, the man behind Tesla Motors and SpaceX, has shown that he can make real what otherwise might seem fanciful. But in the hour ahead, we'll paint a picture of what transportation may actually look like 20 years from now. Will planes, trains, and automobiles all change or all stay largely the same? What breakthroughs are closest? And perhaps most important, what transportation breakthroughs do we need to cool our ever-warming planet? The future of travel, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, in today for Michael Krasny. When Elon Musk, he of Tesla and SpaceX fame, spelled out how people might travel by tube from L.A. to San Francisco in 35 minutes, it sparked enormous media interest. And it got us to thinking here at Forum about the future of travel. Beyond travel by tube, what else may be possible over the next 20 years? What will the cars of the future look like? Will they be all electric? Will they be autonomous? Will boarding a plane in the year 2033 be any different from today's oh-so-fun experience? What about mass transit from buses to BART to high-speed rail? And what will be our best travel option, perhaps not to travel much at all if we're going to curb global warming? That's the topic that we want to take up this hour of Forum. Joining us to do that, Tilo Kozlowski. He's the vice president of Gartner, a technology and advisory company. Tilo, good morning.
Good morning.
Joining us as well is Damon Leverance. He is the transportation editor for Wired Magazine. Damon, good morning as well.
Good morning, Dave.
And joining us from UC Davis this morning, the director of the Institute of Transportation Studies there, Dr. Daniel Sperling. Dr. Sperling, good morning as well.
Good morning, Dave.
Happy to have all of you join us. Well, let's do a once around first on Elon Musk's idea, because that's, after all, what got us started on this topic this week and so much media discussion, including this program this morning. Damon Leverance, as you look at it, give us a short synopsis of what the idea actually is and whether or not it's feasible.
Yeah, I mean, reading over, Musk released this 57-page, what he's calling an alpha white paper, which basically describes the system, how it will be implemented. And he worked on it both himself, and because he has engineers at his disposal from Tesla and SpaceX, they kind of all got together and played with this, about a dozen people in total. And the general idea is two tubes. One traveling essentially from San Francisco, although we can get into the specifics about that, down to LA. And it's kind of inspired by the vacuum tubes we used to use way back in the day. You know, the same thing that would shuttle your—
When you're at a drive-up bank.
Exactly. Shuttle your check into the teller. You know, Paris actually had tons of them running underground in the early 20th century. But while these proposals for these vacuum tube systems have been dreamt about for decades, the biggest problem is twofold. Number one, the amount of air pressure, or I should say lack of air pressure, that's inside. They're trying to make a vacuum, obviously, and that's very difficult to do both from an energy point of view and a safety point of view. And also the heat buildup, how much heat's built up by something at that speed. So Musk's proposal basically is an aluminum, let's call it a shotgun shell for humans. And you get about 24, 26 people in there. And he got around the wind resistance way, wind resistance issue rather, by dropping the pressure, not to a complete vacuum, but about one bar of atmospheric pressure, and then mounting turbines on the front and the rear to shuttle the air that would normally get stuck in front of the vehicle out the back. And combine that with something that's more or less a take on magnetic levitation, like the trains we see in Japan and China. And that'll allow it to accelerate very quickly, transport these aluminum tubes up to a speed of 650, 700 miles per hour, and eventually, you know, make the trip from San Francisco to LA in about 35 minutes.
And so we love thinking about these possibilities, in part perhaps because it's more fun to talk about, write about, think about than the BART strike. but is it very practical, Dan Sperling? Is it worth spending lots of time thinking about, or no?
Well, I tremendously admire Elon Musk. He's done great for, you know, bringing rockets into the private sector, for the electric cars. The guy is obviously brilliant in many ways, but I think he's gone off the deep end here. There's so many reasons why it's not going to work. It's the challenge of building infrastructure, the safety issues, the NIMBYism, the issue that even when you get to where you're going, there's a last mile, first mile problem. Even beyond, and I don't know the technology, details of the technology, how plausible that is, but there's so many other problems. And in the end, it's not even clear that the inner city challenge is the most important one. The more important challenge is within metropolitan areas.
And if that is not where our focus ought to be, it does at least have the benefit of getting us thinking about these important questions. So Dan Sperling, where would you like us to focus? What makes sense to you as being the aspect of travel in the future that will net us the greatest good?
Well, you know, I'm often called a visionary about a lot of things, but I think in this case, there's so many small changes that we can do that are well within reach and are just blocked by institutional, legal, NIMBY kind of problems, that what I'm going to tell you is going to sound rather pedestrian, so to speak. And I will start with pedestrians. For instance, you know, just built, like in Davis here, we have a whole network of bicycle paths where you're not in conflict with cars. And that has led to a huge mode share. You know, about a third of all the trips here are by bikes. And so that's managing land use better so that we build up our downtowns and stop the sprawl that's been going on. And there's lots of, that's already a trend that's starting to happen, so that's good. There's the electric vehicles, and you know, I'll call them zero emission vehicles for the moment. That would be battery electrics, plug-in hybrids, fuel cell, hydrogen vehicles are all good ideas. There's probably one of the ideas that I'm particularly enthusiastic about is using information technologies to transform mobility services. You hear about Uber and some of these other services, but really we can use information here to make it easy for people to either carpool or to have demand responsive transit, a van that comes and picks you up, takes you where you want to go. There's all kinds of small startup companies already offering a lot of these services that are just being quashed by or stymied by all kinds of regulatory rules and safety concerns and others that are really due to the way are due because we have the entrenched taxi interests that don't want competition. We have transit services that have been atrophied for so many years that have difficulty incorporating, working with new ideas. So out there, there's so many good ideas that are moving forward so slowly. In many ways, transportation has been one of the least innovative sectors in our society over the last 60 years. It basically hasn't changed.
Yeah. Let's dig into that a bit more and then take apart some of the modes that are available to us. Do you concur with that, Tilo Kozlowski, that we're kind of atrophied in our thinking and that some of the best future thinking might be to think very small about very simple, straightforward ideas that in some ways make us travel less?
Yeah, absolutely. I do believe, respond also to what Dan said, that technology ultimately will be a huge benefit to optimizing the way we do things today. And that means, in addition to thinking about some grand ideas new ways of transportation, to even optimize what we are doing today. And technology certainly makes a huge, important contribution in that respect.
Give me an example of how that might work. Like Dan Sperling was talking about, making things, optimizing what we can do with how we share certain ride services, Uber and the like. How else could that work?
Well, think about it. Today, transportation is really one of the most disorganized things that we're dealing with on a daily basis. You know, how can we continue to accept something like this when we have technologies that would allow us to have cars talk among themselves, to talk to the infrastructure, to be able to actually understand that you shouldn't take a certain means of transportation at a given time based on traffic, you know, realities that exist, and maybe go to a different type of transportation. That basic information doesn't really exist today, even though we have the technologies out there that easily could capture this type of information.
How can cars talk to each other, Damon Laverinson, and what might that allow us to not do as opposed to do?
Well, we've actually got one study going on in Michigan right now, another pilot program going on in Germany, and it's what's called the V2V and V2I experiment. And a V2V would be vehicle-to-vehicle communications. So every car would be connected with some kind of embedded modem, just like in your cell phone, providing a 3G or 4G data connection. Combine that with an onboard Wi-Fi system, and what you'd be able to do is have these cars talk to each other and say, oh, there's a red light coming up ahead. This vehicle's not slowing down. It'll put a warning on your dashboard. Oh, this guy's about to run a red light. So we've got you know, the safety concerns. Obviously, that's one of the major things that these technologies can bring about. From a larger perspective, and this will probably get into a topic we'll discuss later on. Once we have these V2V technologies and these vehicle to infrastructure technologies, that's going to allow the autonomous vehicle market to really start to move forward.
And autonomous vehicles, for the relatively uninitiated like me, we think of as being driverless, though they're not completely that. And that's, to you, something that really may come forward in the next 10 to 20 years?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've been seeing this technology slowly evolve over the course of the last 15, 20 years or so. It kind of first started with a system that was basically a new take on cruise control. So what you would do is you'd be in your car, you'd set the cruise control, and a radar system in front of the car, a radar sensor, would sense the vehicle in front of you. And when it slowed down, your car would slow down. And then when it sped up, you would speed up.
And what does this give us, Tilo Koslowski? What is the advantage of having a car that does more for us?
Well, it does a couple of things. And most importantly, it will probably reduce the number of accidents that we have, which is unacceptable thinking about how many people actually die or get really seriously injured around the world every day based on car accidents. But on top of this, it helps you to optimize actually your life, because it actually would save you time by being able to understand, are there traffic issues? Because once you have autonomous vehicles, little nodes of cars that actually can communicate with each other, in addition to understanding what is around them, you can take it up to a next level, being able to actually predict how traffic will evolve going forward. And would it be nice if maybe your alarm clock in the future is tied to that type of information and actually lets you sleep in half an hour longer? Because at that point, maybe, you know, on a certain day, you know that the traffic isn't that bad. Of course, the downside is maybe there will be a bad day and you have to get up an hour earlier in order to make it.
But how does this help us in terms of, or does it help us, Dan Sperling, as far as making transportation more efficient, less of an impact on global warming? Do these advances, I understand the safety benefit, but do they do what you're suggesting we ought to do, which is just go ride a bike?
Well, I wasn't not just ride a bike.
I know.
That is a concern of mine, and it's not clear to me that's something we really want to emphasize as a top priority, because indeed, if driving becomes that easy, everyone's going to drive a lot more. People will live out in the suburbs because now the value of time right now in transportation, when we evaluate whether to build a new road, we base it mostly on how much time it saves, and we estimate what the value of time is, $15 an hour or whatever for the person, and multiply it by how many people and how much time. So now the time in the car will be not $15, it'll be close to zero, because you can use it for texting, reading, sleeping, whatever. And that means that there will be an incentive for people to drive more, build more roads. And so that makes me a little apprehensive.
Yeah, come back on that, Damon Laverinson. I mean, it seems like something that's going to promote more use of cars rather than less.
Yeah, I think that's a valid concern. But I also think that there's an inherent American kind of ideal of personal mobility. We like our freedom. We like our individual vehicles. And I don't think that's anything that's going to be going away anytime soon. I think that we like our own individual spaces. One of the many reasons that mass transit on a really large scale hasn't been adopted in the U.S. compared to, say, countries in Europe or other places across the world is very much because people really like their cars. They like their individual space. And it's been something that's been kind of ingrained in the popular consciousness for the last 80 years.
So let's spend a moment then on what that says about the future of mass transit. We'll come back to more advances in cars as we go through our hour. But at this very moment, there's a disabled BART train sitting in the Transbay tube. So just with that little aside, Tilo Kozlowski, what about are we going to get, in the midst of all of the controversies around BART in particular these days, is that anything that is going to flourish in our culture, given what Damon was just saying about our fondness for personal mobility?
Well, at the end of the day, people still use mobility to get from point A to point B in most cases. And, you know, if you have an issue like this where one public transportation system isn't working, it would be great to have technology that can help you understand here are the other choices that you have. And the key word for that is intermodal transportation, meaning you have multiple modes of transportation to choose from based on given realities, based on timing preferences that you have, based on cost. You may go with one over the other. And that has pretty big implications for how we think about transportation going forward. Today, these systems don't talk with each other, and that's one of the biggest problems.
And do we need all of those systems? Do we need Dan Sperling high-speed rail as well as other forms of mass transit? Does that make sense given where we are?
I think we need to get more creative here. And, you know, kind of going along with where some of these comments are starting to go is that the conventional transit, and I'll refer to that as rail transit, even including high-speed rail and buses, really doesn't fit our land use patterns in California and the United States and many other places. Even if you have something that goes, you know, like Elon Musk Hyperloop goes from one place to another, there's not very many people going from one place to another. Our land use is so diffuse, we're so spread out. And so we need a whole new way of thinking about transportation. And there's a lot of opportunities in between the single occupant vehicle and conventional transit that we're barely tapping. So some of them were just using information technology, and that can be used for intermodal in different sorts of ways. If you arrive somewhere, I mean, you can do like smart car sharing, where you have a little vehicle or a bike and you just go to a spot where you can pick up another transit service, or you have transit services, you know, in smaller vehicles that can pick you up. Or there's even something, personal rapid transit, which is personal mobility and does respond to that desire that we have for this personal mobility. And you could take Elon Musk's, you know, big idea about going from L.A. to San Francisco and just make it within the metropolitan area, make it in the San Francisco area or Los Angeles area. You can build these. In fact, I did a paper on this recently, laying some of these ideas out, but it wouldn't have to be at this tremendous high speed. The high speed is not, that's not where the need is. If we could just go 30 or 40 miles per hour on a predictable basis within the Bay Area to get anywhere, most people would take that gladly. So you can create these things that, just like he has, you know, you have overhead, lightweight overhead vehicles, but not high speed, not taking up so much space, not creating the safety problems that actually might be a good idea for our metropolitan area.
So let's use that as an example for a moment, because I think what Dan Sperling just said is really true. If we could count on always being able to go even 40 miles an hour in the Bay Area, that would be a great advancement, right? So how do we get there? What do we need to do to be able to just make transportation more predictable, more efficient for that very specific goal here in the Bay Area, Tilo?
Yeah, we have to be able to get information in real time as quickly as possible. And on top of this, even start to predict how traffic actually evolves. This is a big data problem, you know, ultimately that can be resolved, because we can get lots of insights out of this where we can optimize traffic, modes of transportation, and even our schedules at the end of the day. And again, you know, the whole area of transportation is very unorganized today, and there's no reason for why this is happening. Plus, we know that at the end of the day, consumers would be even willing to share a lot of this transportation-related information with others if that would help to accomplish exactly what we're talking about.
But is that right? I mean, are we really eager to share? I mean, we're not very eager to share rides. So are we really eager to share information? Based on what we've already talked about a little bit in terms of car and culture, it's a solo enterprise.
Yeah, but we did some studies with consumers on this over the years, for over a decade now. And we actually have seen that as consumers learn more and more about information technology in their daily life, having mobile smartphones, having mobile internet, there's a lot of understanding about data. And if there's an opportunity to leverage data for the greater good, there seems to be a pretty strong indication that consumers would be willing to share that.
So is it Damon Lavrin's sort of transferring the culture of social media to cars?
I think it's not so much social media, but I think actually a very good example right now is something that Google's rolled out on its Android devices in the last 6 months called a program called Google Now. And it more or less kind of predicts what your behavior is. So when I was on the way to this interview this morning, it let me know you need to be here at this time. And that means you should leave your house at this time based on current traffic conditions. About 10 minutes before I was supposed to leave, it said, no, leave now. Traffic got worse on the Bay Bridge. So I think leveraging both the GPS capabilities of everybody's smartphone, you know, if we can anonymize that data, which we are to a large extent right now, everybody, you know, most people nowadays have a smartphone in their pockets. You can tell how fast that person's going based on where they are, if they're on the freeway, and leverage that information to actually provide a larger big data scaled amount of information that's going to provide everybody, no matter what they're doing, more accurate travel times, more consistent suggestions as far as travel is concerned. And that way we can make kind of informed choices. You know, today I drove my car in. You know what? Traffic's really bad. Maybe I should ride my motorcycle in today, as an example.
And is that – we have to go to a break in just a moment, Dan Sperling. But that's something that you'd like us to think more about or use information to think more about, which is maybe I should ride a bike. Maybe I should stay home. I mean, maybe that we use this information to make smart choices about either traveling or not.
That is an improvement, but I would emphasize much more creating a whole set of mobility services that will provide opportunities to use our transportation system more efficiently at less cost with less carbon. Just getting people a little better information it's a nice incremental improvement, but we have the opportunity to do much more than that. That'll be much more beneficial at every level.
And we'll take up those ideas when we return to our program. We're going to take a short break. We'd welcome your thoughts on this. What do you dream about in terms of advances in technology? Here are some of the responses we've gotten so far on our Facebook page. Helena writes, planning development more around public and human-powered transportation than just cars. Patrick says, I'd like to see space elevators. Jesse writes, how about rocket cars? Matthew, New York to Melbourne in less than 24 hours. We'd like to hear your thoughts on what you'd like to see in the future of transportation. You can post them on our Facebook page. Call us at 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. And when we return, we'll take up also the kinds of things that we can do, as Dan Sperling was just suggested, that can make a difference in terms of how we impact the environment less as we make our transportation decisions. 866-733-6786 if you want to join us. We'll be back with more in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson, in today for Michael Krasny. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson, in today for Michael Krasny. Our topic this hour, what travel and transportation should look like, what it will look like over the next 20 years, what kinds of new developments will make a real difference in the way we're able to get around, which kinds of developments will make a difference in terms of its impact on global warming. We're joined by Damon Lavrin, transportation editor for Wired, Tilo Kozlowski, vice president of Gartner, a technology and advisory company, and Dr. Daniel Sperling, director of the Institute of Transportation Studies at UC Davis. Dr. Sperling, right before the break, you were talking about the kinds of things we really ought to think about that will make more than an incremental difference. Pick up on that thought with an example.
The real problem in many ways is that we have become so dependent on cars. cars have been basically vanquished all other options for passenger travel. They account for, well, transit accounts for about 2.5% of our passenger travel in the United States today.
Mass transit, yeah, okay.
Mass transit. So, and another piece of that is that for cars, we spend about, on average, about $8,500 per year to own and operate a car, insurance, depreciation, tires, et cetera. $8,500. So even before you get to the social costs, it's just the huge cost on us just to for these vehicles. So the idea is to how do we reduce that dependence and how do we do it at less cost and better quality? And there are many ways of doing it. But the answer is that we need a whole set of new mobility services because no one alternative can compete with that car by itself. So we have this set of services that I was just quickly alluded to before, but I'll just review it really quickly. So we have car sharing, where you can rent a car, and now they have one-way carpools. Daimler's doing that. BMW's doing that. You just rent it. You leave it off where you're going. Bike sharing, same idea. We can have demand-responsive transit, where we just call up on our smartphone. It knows where we are. We just tell where we're going, comes, say, in 5 minutes, 10 minutes, picks us up, takes us where we're going, slight detour, but, you know, not at, at a reasonable cost. And after all, most of us don't want to be driving all the time. We want chauffeurs. Most of us want chauffeurs most of the time. It's not like the system we have now is the ideal or optimal system. In fact, it's one of the most expensive, inefficient systems you can imagine. So you have the car sharing, bike sharing, and the demand responsive. We can have small little cars for local travel. It's crazy to be driving these two-ton vehicles down, you know, a mile away. So actually down in the Los Angeles area, there's a whole set of cities there joined together to do these neighborhood vehicles where they're driving them. They're, these are just small vehicles. They go 25 miles per hour. But indeed, for most trips, that's more than enough, and it works very well. Add to that smart carpooling. There's a company, Zimride. It was just bought by Enterprise Car Rental. And that is, because remember back in college when you had a bulletin board and you signed up to go somewhere? So just digitize this thing. And now if you're going to a ballpark for a game or you're going to a concert or you're just going to work, and if you knew there were people in your area that were making the same trip about the same time, people that you were friends with or colleagues, you'd be willing to do that.
Yeah.
Now we don't have that information. So you put all of this together, throw in electric vehicles and more fuel-efficient vehicles, and now you have a far more efficient system that for most people will be much less expensive. For most people will actually be a better system.
Dr. Dan Sperling, the director of the Institute of Transportation Studies at UC Davis. We'd like to hear what you think of all of this, our listeners today. Would you be willing to take advantage of more of those ride-sharing opportunities using information and technology so that we are less dependent on driving solo for any activity that we choose to engage in? What do you think? Join us at 866-733-6786. Post your thoughts on our Facebook page or email us as well. Let's start hearing from our listeners this morning on this topic. John starts us out in Burlingame. John.
Or morning, I guess. Thanks a lot for this interesting conversation. I'm actually working in the space, a startup that works in vehicle sharing here in the Bay Area. And one of our biggest challenges, and just wanted to kind of pose a question to you guys, is trying to get the automakers to work together and open APIs and get a set of standards. Because a lot of the information that we need is already in the cars. It's just really hard to get our hands on it.
John, clarify, if you would, for me at least, what you mean, APIs?
Sorry, so the cars today are, you know, they're tracking. They have, a lot of them have GPS units and actually cellular modems in the cars already. And the vehicle manufacturers are gathering information, but they're not sharing it with anybody. And so if we could get our hands on a stream of data, a standard stream of data from all these manufacturers that would allow us to use our devices to help in the vehicle sharing and the acquisition of personal and local mobility and car sharing for that matter, it would help us streamline this process and speed everything up because we have an amazing existing infrastructure to leverage. It's just getting the information. Today, all of the small car sharing companies are having to put their own devices in the cars to get this information. And so oftentimes they'll have two redundant systems running because we can't get the information.
Yeah.
So, off the air. Thanks.
Thank you, John. Tilo, pick up on that then, if you would, because this gets to your point about we don't have a very organized system. And what is the information that we need, and how would that benefit us?
So the information that we need basically is to get from each vehicle when it is available, when it is being parked, and at what point you could actually rent it out to somebody else, for example. I think that's what John was talking about. And there's a reason why the car manufacturers are a little bit reluctant on this, because, of course, if you would have a fully functioning car sharing program that everybody adapts, then maybe you don't sell as many cars anymore as a car company. Plus, there's some security concerns in terms of opening up the APIs and getting information to the vehicle that makes it a little bit difficult for the car companies to really feel warm and fuzzy about this. But at the same time, there are car companies out there like GM that are opening up their vehicles. For example, OnStar, which is a subsidiary of General Motors, opened up their APIs so that you can actually work with relay rides.
And APIs, again, stands for?
Application Protocol Interface. You know, so having information about the vehicle, being able to unlock the car via your phone instead of having actually a key and being able to drive off as soon as I give you permission to do so.
What about ideas like I read this article last night, Damon Leverance, about I think it was BMW that's putting out an electric car, and if you buy it, you also get access to an SUV, one of those two-ton cars that Dan Sperling was referring to, but just when you want it, as opposed to driving that when you don't need it all over town.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest issue right now is, with the exception of Tesla, most of the electric vehicles on the market are only getting about an 80 to 100-mile range. So what happens if you want to, say, take a trip to the coast for the weekend? Yeah, what BMW is offering, they've actually launched a sub-brand within BMW called BMW i that's going to exclusively sell electric and hybrid electric vehicles. And their first model is something called the i3. It's a very compact, kind of a mini-sized vehicle, essentially. And what they're offering, essentially, is a, you know, if you need to, say, and this is bundled into the price of the car, if you need to take a trip, you can rent, say, a 5 Series from them or get a get an X5, the large SUV you were talking to. Interestingly, Chrysler did this as well with Fiat. Of course, Fiat's owned by Chrysler's owned by Fiat now. Fiat just released its first electric car earlier this year, the 500e. So you've seen the 500 before, and they made an electric version. Part of the plan with that is they struck a deal with Enterprise that allows you to get one free car rental a month.
Yeah, I mean, this seems to me, Dan Sperling, to make a lot of sense, so that you're using the appropriate vehicle for the appropriate task at hand, right?
Yes, you nailed it. But it can. This is just the beginning. I mean, the part of the challenge is the car companies, the academic researchers, we don't really know what people want and are willing to pay for. So, you know, BMW is, you know, I drove their i3 last week, and, you know, I was pretty enthusiastic. But it is the kind of story where we have this whole range of technologies. We have plug-in hybrids also. We have the Toyota plug-in Prius that only gets 10 miles of all-electric range and then goes into hybrid mode. We have the GM Volt that gets 40 miles of all-electric range and then goes into hybrid mode. We have the i3, the BMW car, is also going to have a feature or a special feature that if you pay extra, about $4,000, you get a little range extender, a motorcycle engine that will let you go another 80 miles or so, you know, if you run out of juice. So all the car companies, and then we have fuel cell vehicles that, you know, in the end might be the best solution of all. And we also have the little neighborhood electric cars that are even smaller that some of the companies have been pursuing. So we have, I mean, to the extent we stick with our single-occupant vehicle, and certainly that's going to be a mainstay for a long time, even within that, no one really knows how that's going to play out. All the car companies are making a large number of bets. They're kind of frustrated because it costs, you know, a lot of money for them to do a battery EV, a plug-in hybrid, a fuel cell vehicle, and as well as getting into all the electronics and connected car technology. So it is, you know, even though I lay out a vision with all these other new things, even for the car, it's really a transformation that's happening, and it's a very exciting time.
Some more transportation wish list items coming in on our Facebook page. Kevin says he wants a Hyperloop car. on a personal basis that would run on a track of magnetic induction tiles. Susie's wish is much simpler, a U-turn signal. I think that's actually a great idea. Sharon says, how about efficient, reliable public transportation that just gets us from one place to another? There's a dream. Mike in Belmont says, your naysaying guest from Davis, Dan Sperling, cited a number of reasons that the Hyperloop won't work, including NIMBYism, the last mile problem, etc. But is that any different from California's high-speed rail project? Just briefly, Dan Sperling, it's the same issues, right?
In many ways, it is the same issues, and yes, exactly, it is the same issues.
And Ruth tweets, a conventional baby boomer wisdom that Americans love cars have prevented viable transit, prohibiting us from even trying it. And that's what Janine in Berkeley wants to talk about as well. Janine, go ahead.
Hi, thanks. I really wanted to object to that comment from the guest that transportation has been more successful in Europe because the Europeans don't share our obsession for the individual auto. I mean, in reality, that's a very outmoded concept. I mean, I think we know that the reason it's successful in Europe is because of urban densities that were created long before the automobile, for one. And the other is because of the availability of national or federal funding for public transportation, which has not been available in the U.S. And in fact, our federal dollars have gone to heavily subsidize our road infrastructure and promote the automobile. So I think really the solution is urban density and creating better co-locations of the things, you know, that we need to get to every day. And to move on to the issue of the, why does public transport sometimes fail us, I think part of the problem is very good for point-to-point trips, but it's not great for multiple legs.
Right.
You know, so if I need to pick up the kids and do grocery shopping and get to work, you know, it's overwhelming to think about doing that on transit.
Yeah, exactly, Janine. Thank you. I mean, does mass transit, this is sort of a basic question, but to Janine's point, does it really make sense given our geography and everything else? Because are we really dense enough to make that work, Thilo?
Yeah, so I definitely believe that cars are here to stay, passenger vehicles, for exactly that reason. Because I don't think that at the end of the day, consumers and people that need transportation are willing to give up convenience and comfort in their own little space and get to the point where they exactly need to get to. There are certain situations if you have to go to a big company where it makes sense to have mass transportation. If you go to a sporting event, something big. But in many other cases, I just don't see that changing. Now, there's a big opportunity to optimize what we're already doing today. There's a big opportunity to maybe even better use the road infrastructure that we have today. I don't want to demonize the automobile because I think there's so much more potential in it. They will get more efficient, those cars. We'll be able to pick different vehicles, forms of types and vehicles based on our specific needs that we have. I'm just not convinced that we all really want public transportation.
Is that where you'd place your bet as well, Damon Lavrence? Is our best option to be more efficient, to harm the earth less, to get where we want to go in an efficient way is to utilize the car or bike or do with what we have as opposed to massive new mass transit opportunities?
I mean, I'm sure a hybrid approach is probably the smarter bet at this point. But I totally agree with Thilo. The fact is people aren't willing to sacrifice their convenience. You know, they like the point-to-point availability of being able to go from their house to their work.
Where it makes sense is in a place like New York where the most convenient thing to do is to take the subway.
Exactly. But, you know, I think, you know, it brings up a more interesting and larger point right now is the generation that's coming up behind us have completely different views of how these transportation systems should work. I mean, we're seeing, particularly in California, we're seeing license adoption, you know, people getting a license at 16. That's going away. That's not nearly as high as it used to be. People are waiting for a multitude of reasons.
Well, that's interesting. Let's spend a moment on that. Do you think there will be regulatory changes, Dan Sperling and then Thilo Koslowski, making it harder to get a license, for example?
Well, that's already been happening. There are these graduated licenses. It used to be when we were 16, when I was young, you turned 16, you got your license, and you're often going and driving. Now you can only drive certain hours. You have to have an adult, you know, with you for part of the time. You can't drive at night, and so it takes several years to work through that. So we are doing that, and I don't think we're going to go too much further in that direction, just because you know, we are a society built around transit. Is not available to most people in most cases, and so we're not going to get away from it. But you know, I want to add one thing about this discussion about personal mobility versus transit. We can do personal mobility in a far more efficient way. There are all the things I talked about in terms of using information to develop new mobility services. But if you're going to be a little visionary, you take kind of the Elon Musk idea of a lightweight infrastructure, a tube kind of thing or a track. You can have very lightweight vehicles that are personal vehicles. It can hold one, two, three, four people that would go on these tracks. It would be electric, so it would be very efficient, but it would have a small battery in it. And these tracks would be for the line haul part of a trip, you know, where our freeways are and some of our arterials. And then you peel off from that when you're going into lower density areas, and then you have a small battery that'll take you another 30 or 40 miles, and then you can get back on it. So we are stuck with a system that is very inefficient, and it is slow to change, because it is complex. But we don't need high-tech solutions to come up with a far more efficient, less carbon, less energy, less cost, and it can be a personal mobility system with a little bit of the transit services, these mobility services where some people can share rides, we can have van pools that come and pick us up and take us where we want to go. So there are many, many opportunities, and one of the challenges is to work with all these regulatory rules and other kinds of permitting process and somehow try to make it easier to allow these new companies and new services to evolve, because right now we're basically suffocating the baby in the crib.
Right. Well, and it would seem, Tilo Kosowski, that within American culture, the way to sell this idea is not to take away the idea of mobility and individual choice. If you start mandating you can only drive between the hours of 7 and 10 or whatever, you're not going to get very far.
That's true, but at the same time, I think we might face a future where this is the only way of doing things going forward, because we'll have more people owning vehicles or wanting to have transportation. And we need mobility as an economy, as a society. I would even go as far as saying it's a human right, especially when you get old and you might not be able to actually steer your own automobile anymore. So I could envision that governments going forward might redefine some of the privileges that we have today. Mind you, we don't have the right to operate and drive a vehicle on the road. It's a privilege. And maybe that means going forward that governments will enforce, to some extent, intermodal transportation. If you drive fast on the highway on the weekend, maybe you will be forced for the rest of the week to use public transportation because you exceeded your CO2 allowance.
I'd like to see a candidate run on that platform. comments about self-driving cars coming in on our Facebook page and website. Beth writes, my question is, what about insurance? Who gets blamed if there's an accident with no real driver? You want to take that on, Damon?
Yeah, absolutely. Understand, first of all, that we're not going to be in the position where there's nobody, or at least not at the beginning, where we're in a situation where there's nobody behind the wheel. It's going to be a setting. It's going to be a switch you flip, and that allows for, in like new vehicles are coming out right now, a low speed kind of traffic jam assistant that just kind of keeps up the car ahead of you, allows you to maybe check your email and that kind of thing. But to her point more specifically, the insurance industry always figures this stuff out. And I think one of the actual great things about the amount of data that's going to be coming into these cars is the fact that if something happens either based on driver error, on the vehicle error, or the computer systems themselves, there's going to be a log. There's going to be a virtual paper trail for this. And I think that's actually going to make the liability issues less.
To another caller, Johan in Berkeley joins us next. Go ahead, please.
Good morning. Just had a few comments and a question regarding the information technology portion of a lot of these proposals you've been discussing. I mean, first of all, these creative ruminations of improving, an economy and making it more efficient as well as protecting the environment is laudable. It truly is. I have some concerns, especially in light of a lot of government surveillance programs which have been revealed as to what privacy safeguards are going to be put in place from the get-go to protect people's information and ensure that it's not shared in ways that they probably wouldn't want it to be shared. And I got to say, I mean, I don't have a lot of faith. I'm actually software recruiter for Silicon Valley. I mean, there's big data Google model of get it out there and let the marketplace figure it out. We'll deal with the problems on the back end. Really doesn't give me a lot of confidence that those kind of safeguards are going to be in place, and it's really just going to be a rush to see who can do it first and make the most money.
Great question, Johan. Thanks, Tilo.
Yeah, so absolutely. This is a sticky issue, obviously. Nobody wants to share where they are at what point in time 24/7 for good reasons. But, you know, there's a way to make that data anonymous. Plus, you know, we actually did a study with consumers in the United States, with vehicle owners, and we found that over 60% are willing to share the information if they get some form of a benefit back. That could be one there.
And remind us again, for those of us who are new to some of these concepts, why having that information, anonymous or not, how that would make our transportation systems more efficient?
Just being even at the most simple level able to communicate and know where vehicles are at a given time at a given location would allow us to reroute traffic. That would tremendously improve traffic flow, would reduce emissions at that point. If you know that when we have car-to-car communication, autonomous vehicles, that you can get very close to a vehicle driving ahead of you, you can do what's called platooning. That could, again, minimize actually some of the wind resistance that you have, improve fuel efficiency, optimize the usage of the road. So these pieces of information are very important. And again, I could imagine that the government may force you to do so.
Hugh in Oakland has a question. Hugh, go ahead.
Yeah, fuel cell cars, we've been told, will be more efficient, yet we haven't seen any of them yet. Fuel cell buses, hydrogen fuel cell buses, are all over the place. Why is one prevalent, the other not, and are there same or different technologies?
Great. Thanks, Hugh. Damon, and give us a quick one-on-one on fuel cells along the way.
Yeah, so, I mean, right now, the majority of alternative powertrain vehicles are battery electric vehicles. Fuel cell vehicles basically take in hydrogen, convert it to energy, send it to an electric motor, and the only thing that outputs is water molecules.
And to Hugh's question, yeah, why do they work with buses, not cars?
Well, it's infrastructure. That's the biggest issue more than anything else. With the buses, they all go to the same station to fill up. They've got a larger area, so they're not so concerned about some of the safety issues, and they're also in a condensed area. The problem is if we put a hydrogen fuel cell vehicle on the market today, we don't have a place to fill up. And if I want to, say, travel from New York to LA, there's no stations available to me.
And on that question of providing the kind of support services you need for those alternative vehicles, are we getting closer to that with electric cars? Read something recently about Tesla creating these battery swapping stations so you could swap out a battery on your way and keep going?
No, Tesla's model actually started with their supercharger network, which rolled out on the West Coast first. And it basically allows you to plug in your car and get a very quick charge, about 30 to 45 minutes to about 80 or 90% capacity. Those stations are also now going to have the ability to swap out a battery pack altogether. The problem with the Tesla solution is it's only for Tesla models. Mm. So this isn't available to any other EV owners.
It brings up this question again of kind of organization and how you kind of create a way to support these new things. And here's a question from John, and Dan Sperling take this on, about John's question is, how does the state try to address its future in an integrated way? Is there a comprehensive approach, or are state agencies acting in silos? And Airboard deals with air quality, Caltrans builds highways, locals deal with transit. So it's an interesting point that John is making about this question of organization is not only how you organize it between individuals, it's also these larger regulatory bodies.
Well, that kind of hits the nail on the head. You know, we have a incredibly complex society and complex sets of institutions. So I sit now, I'm a board member for the California Air Resources Board. So I've seen firsthand what's going on with a lot of these technologies and options. And yes, we do have different agencies with different responsibilities, and it's all logical. We in the United States, we like local government. We like, you know, home rule. We don't want, you know, some despot or dictator telling us what to do. So we've created this very complex set of governments and institutions. So let me just give you one little example with hydrogen fuel cell vehicles.
And just, I'm sorry, Dan, but just real briefly because we're almost out of time.
Okay, real quickly is most of the car companies want to bring out in a major way fuel cell vehicles. They want to sell them, but there's no one out there providing the fuel infrastructure, the hydrogen stations, and the oil companies say, well, it's not big enough for us to be, care about it, and so they're not willing to invest. And so now we have this chicken and egg problem, and in this case, the local governments in L.A. and San Francisco and the state, the Air Resource Board, the Energy Commission are working together to try to make it happen. We have some stations out there. We're aiming for having about 100 out there within a few years. And then the car companies will be, they're very excited about it. But it just shows that nothing is easy.
Yeah. And on that thought, given that nothing is easy, what are you the most hopeful about, Thilo and then Damon?
Well, I'm hopeful about the fact that going forward, all cars will be connected, that we have the opportunity to capture information, better optimize it, share it with different audiences, share it with different companies and organizations to optimize what we're talking about.
And make smart travel choices, which sometimes might mean not to travel.
Absolutely. You know, and I think we're entering this phase, what we call of smart mobility. This is a new era. Really.
Just like smartphones. Damon, absolutely. Last thought?
Yeah, absolutely. I know. I echo everything Thilo says. And I think that, you know, for the people that don't enjoy driving, they've got plenty of options. For those of us that do, lots of options for us as well. And some of the best powertrain and engineering processes going in right now are going to help push forward some of the greatest vehicles we'll see in the next lifetime.
Damon Lavrins, transportation editor for Wired, joining us along with Thilo Koslowski of Gartner and Dr. Dan Sperling, director of the Institute of Transportation Studies at UC Davis. Thanks all very much for being part of this conversation. Thanks, too, to our producers, Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lorberg, our engineer, Danny Bringer, our senior editor, Dan Zoll, our executive producer, Raul Ramirez, and our engagement producer, Amanda Stupai. I'm Dave Iverson, in for Michael Krasny today. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.